I'm Ozzy, I'm an alcoholic, and I want to welcome you all here on behalf of the Wilson House again. It's just such a pleasure having Wally and the people here, and the spirit here is absolutely incredible. I can feel it. It's part of it, the smiles, the laughter. It's just absolutely wonderful. The presence of God is here. I just want to say one little thing about the best group in the country, and that's right here in East Dorset, our local group. And this is pretty big. And back a year ago, okay, at this seminar, we had two people here. They were just coming up on their first year. They can't be here today. And they're so disappointed. And Sue and Roland, they were just coming up on their first year. They heard Wally, and it changed their lives around. They said, "Can we do it?" And so we put a thing in. Our group, our beginners group, decided would sponsor it. Now these two people, and coming up on a year, but on the seminar on Sunday night, for four Sundays in a row, we put it in, and we're way out in the country. We had something like 60 people show up. We ended with 50 people after 4 weeks. People's lives were changed. God had worked with these people. And as soon as it was over, the first thing, they said, "When can we have it again?" Last month, we just finished the third time we've done it in a year. The third time, we ended up with over 70 people coming. We ended up with about 55 at the final one. And what it's done for the people, and some of these people traveled each way as much as 50 miles. And they were all blessed. And we got notes where actually people said they wouldn't be alive today if it wasn't for the 4 hours they spent here. So I just want to pass that along. This works, and our group proved it. And it wasn't by people with me, you know, with time in the program. I could have never done it. It took in our group two people just a little bit less than a year to put it on. They're still putting it on, and I couldn't even touch them. They're just wonderful. And I can testify for what it did in their lives and the other ones, too, that have been through this. Also, too, I want to just tell you a little bit of story here about... I like Bill's grandfather, all right? But before I get into that, by the way, a little bit of history of the house. Right over here is the back of the bar that was out in the front room. When Bill, if you go up there, on the top drawers, there's hats where they used to lock up the money. Underneath the hats were there, they used to lock up the liquor. And that used to sit out there. So when you go up there, that's where it all happened. Up there, we found this about a year ago, right up over there. And that's the original top of the bar in the house. That's 9 feet long, not a knot in that piece of wood, 31 inches wide, over an inch thick, rough cut in the backside, hand planed on the front. You can't find a piece of wood like that. We're going to get a plaque up there. But that's when you look at that, look how many drinks were over there. Bill drank at that, Bill's grandfather, Bill's father, everyone. So anyway, that's something. But I want to talk a little bit about Bill's grandfather. Bill's grandfather, Grandfather Wilson, was known as the town alcoholic, plus the town statesman. Incredible. That makes sense. He was a smart guy. All right, I'm going to expand this a little bit more. How Bill's grandfather happened to get here. Well, the Barrows family built this hotel. Okay, this was a vacant lot in 1846. 1852, it opened as a hotel. The Wilsons lived down in Manchester. Bill's grandfather, at the age of 17, 18, got out of high school. He tried working in the quarries up here. And the quarries, he decided, boy, that's too dangerous to work. When you get up there and see those quarries and see the rock, I can understand why. He said, plus the work is too hard. He said, there's got to be a softer, easier way to make a living. Now you're starting to get the hint. So anyway, he decided, and the other industry here was working out in the woods. And he tried that for a while and said, oh boy, in the summer there's just too many bugs. That's also too dangerous. You know, getting bitten, and who wants to spend their life out in the woods? He said, there's got to be a softer, easier way to make a living. So he came upon this brilliant idea. Why don't I marry somebody that's going to inherit a bar? Now, I think that's some pretty sound thinking. And sure enough, down these stores with this pretty little young thing, Helen Barrows. And she was the only surviving daughter. and he courted her, and sure enough, they fell in love right after, you know, and they got married, and a little while after that, both her parents died. Immediately after that, the sign got changed from the Barrow House to the Wilson House. We have old pictures of that where it said the Wilson House. And that's how it got to be the Wilson House. And Bill's grandfather did not die 9 years before Bill was born here. But I'm not going to go into that, but I want to tell you, to finish the story about Bill's grandfather being the alcoholic. Every year, over at this church, they'd call in an outside preacher to save the souls that this guy couldn't save. It used to be called the Federation Church. And this was very close to Prohibition. They had all kinds of restraints on this hotel, serving and that. And back in those days, this was a serious thing. The women would actually get out and wreck the place and things like that up here. And we've got the records of the town meetings over there. And when they had this revival over here, they decided to take and close the hotel, the bar. So Bill's grandfather had it up on top of Mount Aeolus up here. And there's no proof of this. I mean, he had it up, we know that, but about bringing a jug with him. Like, can you imagine going up on a beautiful Sunday morning without a jug in your back pocket? Okay, so we're pretty 99 cents for sure he had a jug in his back pocket. Because I know I wouldn't go up there on a nice Sunday afternoon. I don't think any of you would either. Okay? I mean, that would be complete insanity. So anyway, he's up there with his jug. At about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, he comes down off the mountain. And boy, he's got a determined look on his face. He's heading straight for that church. And he gets to the church, and he opens up the doors. And he stands silhouetted in the doorway, and the people are just staring at him. They turn around. And he starts taking a powerful stride down the aisle. He gets to where the preacher is up on the pulpit, and he tells him to get off the pulpit. The people just didn't know what to do. He had that look, and that preacher just moved off that pulpit real quick. And Bill's grandfather got up there and talked about being on top of the mountain, and the blinding white light that came over him, and being in the presence of God. And he preached for an hour on it, and he never drank after that. And I first heard this story from Bill Wilson's sister, and then from her grandchildren. And that's on the strong side. And then if you look in the story of Bill W. by Townsend, part of it's in there. And that's another thing in Bill's thing. All of a sudden he has a grandfather that's a real drinker, and then he goes on the wagon, and no one knew what to do with him. So just a little story, and tomorrow I got another story about Bill's grandfather and two unsung heroes, which we'll get into Sunday morning, and that's Waldo is and Clarence is the other one. Without these two unsung heroes, we wouldn't have AA today. We'll get into that tomorrow. So I just want to thank you, and I want to thank Wally, and again, part of the Wilson House, we welcome him. All right? Thank you all.
Thank you, Alvin. Oh. We are walking, it is, we are walking among spiritual giants here, And Ozzy is not only a spiritual giant, but what a storyteller the man has become over the years. And if you ever get a chance just to sit down and listen to him spin a few yarns, please take the time to do it. It certainly changed my life. Thanks, Oz. In terms of the third session, this is the session where we're going to be turning our character liabilities or shortcomings over to God in steps 6 and 7. And setting up to make amends and restitution in 8 and 9. But before we get into that, I did want to spend a minute to discuss the reason that we are doing this. This is Toot Toot. And Toot Toot is like the boat without a rudder. And a boat without a rudder ends up just going around in circles. And here is poor Toot Toot, having no idea where he's going. And as a result, he ends up getting in trouble. Lots of trouble. And that's the story of our lives. Without a rudder to guide us, we end up either stepping on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate, or we end up the head-on collision with reality. And I just wanted to open up with that. But I also wanted to make sure that everyone gets the opportunity to share in one of the miracles of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a lost piece of our history. And that is this June 26, 1945, Look magazine article, The Case History of an Alcoholic. A lot of people know about the Liberty and the Saturday Evening Post articles, but this is the piece of AA history that contains the encapsulation of the entire program as it existed in the mid-1940s. This is why it worked. And the slides that I have will correspond to the magazines that I will show. The reason that this is so important is because this is a case history of Joe. And Joe is an alcoholic who makes two telephone calls. And this is a true story. There's no way you could do this in the 90s. By the time the lawyers got through with this, there would be no article whatsoever. but they were able to do this in the 40s because this is Joe on his last bender. And these are not doctored photographs. These are not actors. These are actual human beings in the Minneapolis area. Joe makes two phone calls. He calls Alcoholics Anonymous and he calls Look Magazine. Alcoholics Anonymous sends two people to 12-Step Joe, and Look Magazine sends a photographer. And this is actually what happened. You can tell these photographs aren't doctored. This is Joe on his last bender. And Joe is going down for the count. Here's Joe being 12-stepped by his sponsors-to-be. These are the people that from Alcoholics Anonymous. And in panel number two, they actually talked Joe into going into detox, into treatment. Told he needs hospitalization. He has a temporary change of heart. And he claims it was all a mistake. Calling these people in the first place. So because he's had the change of heart, they actually have to physically manhandle him into the vehicle. Because Joe doesn't want to go anymore. And here's Joe arriving at the sanitarium, at detox, with one eye open and one eye closed. You can tell that this is not dark. There's no way you can reproduce these photographs. And after getting into detox, the person that 12-stepped him, his sponsor, puts him into bed. And on the next day, here's panel number six, and Joe remains in a fog on his second day at the sanitarium. And if you see a close, you need to take a look at close-up of this, because you can just the look on his face, Joe is saying, you know, where the hell am I and who the hell are you? He obviously doesn't have a clue. Like I said, the lawyers would have a field day with this. That's why you can't do it today. But here's Joe on his third day, drinking lots of water to try to work his way through the DTs and also through the alcohol withdrawal. And here it is on panel number eight. Physically restored after 3 days, Joe waves goodbye to his nurse. In fresh clothing provided by his sponsors, he looks and feels a new man. For the first time, he faces the future with hopes for recovery. It's the Minnesota Sanitarium. We do know during this period of time, in 1945, they were conducting the beginner's meetings, the Minnesota group. Actually, it was one of the two groups in Minnesota that were holding beginner's meetings. And this is what happened to Joe. In the top panels, we see Joe meeting with his sponsor. Joe going to his weekly AA meeting, his weekly beginner's meeting, and Joe back at his old job. And the final panel is the summation of the entire recovery process. The cycle of AA therapy is complete when Joe returns to the sanitarium to visit another who needs help. This is only several weeks later. He now has a rough grasp of AA principles, knows that helping other alcoholics is a technique for preserving his own sobriety. For the first time in 10 years, he feels he has found a path to a decent life. It's too early to tell whether he'll stay on it, but AA's record of 75% recovered is in his favor. What a precious encapsulation of our program. And if you have a chance to look through this later, please please do so, because I've never seen anything so clearly, such a clear encapsulation of the recovery process as it was in the 1940s. Okay. This is the third in a series of four Alcoholics Anonymous beginners meetings. It is the fall of 1946, and we are attending an AA meeting in which newcomers are being taken through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in 4 one-hour sessions. For those of you who are planning to lead the beginners meeting, we want to assure you that there are no rules on how to do it. Our format is based on written and oral histories of old-timers throughout the United States and Canada, but it is still our interpretation of how these sessions were taught in the mid-1940s. Please feel free to modify or adapt our approach to your specific needs. As you move out from the Wilson House to your home groups throughout the United States, please feel free to modify this to fit your individual needs. We have found that keeping it as simple as possible is important, and staying as close to the 1940s format is quite helpful. Well, welcome to the third session of the Alcoholics Anonymous Beginners Meetings. Together we're taking the 12 steps as described in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our objective is to find a God of our understanding who will free us from the deadly affliction of alcoholism. Our names are Wally and Steve, and we are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're here to guide you on your journey towards a spiritual solution to your drinking problem. In the past 2 weeks, we have taken steps 1 through 4. Hopefully during the past week, each newcomer has taken the fifth step with another person. Let's see how many are still on track, on the beam, as some of us like to say. Will all the newcomers who have completed their four-step inventories and have shared them with another person please stand? Who has completed the work? Oh, my God. Woo! Let's give them a hand. Absolutely unbelievable for the short period of time that we gave you to do this. And my hats are off to everybody that sponsored, especially those that sponsored 2 and 3 people. Yes, let's give a hand to the sponsors. Yes. Woo!
We congratulate you for having the willingness, honesty, and humility to do what is necessary to recover from alcoholism. You're well on your way to that promised spiritual awakening. We want you to know that everything you hear and read tonight and next week is for your benefit. You've done the work. Now you will receive the rewards. Thank you. Please be seated. As we said last week, we don't care who did the writing, just as long as you and your sponsor came up with a list of character defects and a list of people to whom you need to make your amends. You will turn over your shortcomings to God in steps 6 and 7, and you will make restitution to those whom you've harmed in steps 8 and 9. Those newcomers who have not completed their inventories, please stay. You may hear something that will motivate you to complete your steps 4 and 5 in the near future. But please keep in mind, you will not be receiving the benefits and blessings we will be talking about tonight. We are now entering the phase of the program where more and more actions are required. These actions produce results. Many of these actions are in the form of promises, which as our lives change, become an integral part of our spiritual being. If our lives didn't get better, why would we want to stay sober? If all we had to look forward to was restlessness, irritability, and discontentment, why do the work? AA offers so much more, a new way of living, far more beautiful than anything we could ever imagine. That's why we take the steps. Let's see what's in store for us. But before we do, let's review what the Big Book says about Step 5.
Step 5. Admit to God, to ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. In the middle of the second paragraph on page 72, the Big Book authors tell us why we need to admit our shortcomings to another person. Starting with the 9th line in the second paragraph, they state, "The best reason first. If we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking." Well, that's pretty clear, isn't it? If we don't do the work, well, we're going to die. I think that's a good motivator. Time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives. trying to avoid this humbling experience, they have turned to easier methods. As Ozzy said, the easier, softer way. Mm-hmm. Almost invariably, they got drunk. Having persevered with the rest of the program, they wondered why they fell. We think the reason is that they never completed their house cleaning. They took inventory, all right, but hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egoism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves. But they had not learned enough of humility, fearlessness, and honesty in the sense we find it necessary until they told someone else all their life story. We share our inventory because we are great at self-deception. Aren't we the ones that used to say that we didn't have a drinking problem? Didn't we tell ourselves over and over that we were doing fine as we were sinking deeper and deeper into the abyss of alcoholism? I know for me, I had this pain in my side that was so tremendous that I couldn't even see straight through the pain. And the only thing that stopped the pain was to stop drinking. But I never associated it with the fact that my liver and kidneys were shutting down and I was dying. All I knew is I had to stop drinking long enough for the pain to go away, then I could start drinking again. And that almost killed me. Talk about self-deception. Since we're not good judges of character, especially our own, we confide in somebody else. Only another person can see us as we truly are.
As we discussed last week, we can share our inventory with any number of people. Some of those mentioned on page 74 of the Big Book are church leaders, doctors, psychiatrists, and friends. The person we choose has to be closed-mouthed, trustworthy, and supportive. He or she must never discuss our inventory with anyone else. Starting with the seventh line in the last paragraph on page 74, the Big Book authors write, "It is important that he be able to keep a confidence, that he fully understand and approve what we are driving at, that he will not try to change our plan." The Big Book authors give us specific instructions for taking the fifth step. At the top of page 75, they tell us that as soon as we decide who is to listen to our inventory, we take action immediately. When we decide who is to hear our story, we waste no time. We have a written inventory and we are prepared for a long talk. We explain to our partner what we are about to do and why we have to do it. He should realize that we are engaged upon a life and death errand. Most people approached this way will be glad to help. They will be honored by our confidence. In the second paragraph on page 75, the Big Book authors provide us with more directions. We pocket our pride and go to illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Then they announce that after we have shared our inventories, we will be rewarded. Further on, in the second paragraph on page 75, the Big Book authors provide us with a list of benefits we receive as the result of taking this step. Once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. We are now well on our way toward recovering from alcoholism. The Big Book authors state we are in the process of having a spiritual experience. And as a result, our obsession to drink is being removed. Please review this paragraph often. Think about how these promises are coming true in your lives. They certainly have come true in ours.
In the next paragraph, the Big Book authors give us specific directions on what to do after we have finished sharing our inventories. Returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first five proposals, we ask if we have omitted anything. If we are building an arch through which we shall walk, a free man at last. Is the work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? The Big Book authors propose that we review the first five steps to make sure we haven't omitted anything. If you have done this, you are ready to proceed to the sixth step.
Step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. In step six, the big book authors have us answer a simple question. Starting with line 3 in the first paragraph on page 76, they ask, are we now ready to let God remove from us all things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can He take them all, every one? If we still cling on to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. So according to the big book authors, it is decision time once again. We realize they want you to take your sixth step on the same evening you share your fourth step with your sponsor. In case your sponsor didn't direct you to page 76 of the big book, we'll take you through the sixth step now. If you've already completed the sixth step, we'll ask that you take it again now with the group. During the fifth step, we identified our character defects using the assets and liabilities checklist we discussed last week. In step six, we make preparations necessary to turn these character defects over to God. Let's start with a moment of silence so we can ask God for the willingness to have Him remove all the shortcomings we found in our inventories.
Moment of silence.
Now, will the newcomers who have completed the fifth step please stand? This is the sixth step question. Are you now ready to have God remove from you all things which you have admitted are objectionable? Please answer one at a time. We'll start here on the right.
Yes.
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 All right. Great.
Yes.
Job.
Yes.
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 All right. Oh, great. Oh, that's great.
What about the back row? Is the back row still with us? Or are you auditing now? Yes!
Yes. Unanimous.
Unanimous.
All right.
Let's give ourselves a hand.
All right. Congratulations.
Over the hump. Six down.
Those of you who have answered yes to this question have completed the sixth step and are now ready to proceed to step seven.
Step seven. Humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. This step is straightforward. It consists of a prayer. The prayer is found in the second paragraph on page 76. It reads, my Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. We would like each of you who is ready to take the seventh step to read the prayer along with us a second time. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. According to the Big Book authors, we have completed step seven. Now it's time to clear away the wreckage of our past. We do this by making amends or restitution.
Step 8. Made a list of persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. The big book authors state, made a list. Do we need to make this list? Actually, no. We made our list as part of our fourth step. In the middle of page 76, the big book authors confirm this. Now we need more action. Without which, we find that faith without works is dead. Let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of all persons we have harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. That's why we hold on to our fourth step inventory. It contains our eighth step amends list. For those newcomers who made an amends list as part of their fourth step inventory, congratulations. You have completed the eighth step. Let's move on to step nine.
Are we on a roll or what? Okay. Just following directions. Step nine. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. I just want to make a comment as we were going through the sixth step. For the first time, I realized how organized we're all getting here in terms of going back and forth across the rows to take the steps, and it scared me. No, it's just we're not normally organized in any sense of the matter. But wow.
It's amazing. Yeah, it is amazing.
To see
it's great.
40 people do the work to recover from alcoholism right here in one room at the very house where Bill Wilson was born. I know Bill is here with us. Dr. Bob, too.
Yeah.
And I think they're happy with what they're seeing. Step nine. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. The amends process is explained in detail on pages 76 through 83. On page 76, starting with the sixth line in the third paragraph, the Big Book authors tell us what to do. Now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris which has accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. If we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. So here again, we're relying upon God. If we don't have the will to make an amends, we ask God for the willingness to make the amends. In the next paragraph on page 76, the Big Book authors provide us with some insight as to how to approach some of those to whom we owe an amends. Probably there are still some misgivings. As we look over the list of business acquaintances and friends we have hurt, we may feel diffident about going to some of them on a spiritual basis. Let us be reassured. To some people, we need not and probably should not emphasize the spiritual feature on our first approach. We might prejudice them. At the moment, we are trying to put our lives in order, but this is not an end in itself. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. In the last sentence in this paragraph, the authors clearly state our purpose for living. They tell us why we're here, to serve God and our fellows. And as James has passed on to us, we make amends to become life changers. We do not know as we go out to make these amends who God is going to use us as a channel to help save somebody else's life. But somebody else's life is going to be saved or changed as a result of our making amends. We've seen it happen time and time again. As my sponsor said, we always know what God's will is for us 6 months after it happens. So all I have to do is wait. And please, let us know whose life was changed as a result of you making an amends. Because we'd love to hear how the process is working in your life.
Then on page 77, they ask us to let our actions, rather than our words, demonstrate to others that we have changed. Starting with line 4, they write, "It is seldom wise to approach an individual who still smarts from our injustice to him and announce that we have gone religious. In the prize ring, this would be called leading with the chin. Why lay ourselves open to being branded fanatics or religious bores? We may kill a future opportunity to carry a beneficial message. But our man is sure to be impressed with a sincere desire to set right the wrong. He is going to be more interested in our demonstration of goodwill than our talk of spiritual discoveries." I didn't read that the first time around.
You led with the chin?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
One of the most difficult amends to make is someone we genuinely don't like. But whether we like them or not, we must proceed. In the first paragraph on page 77, starting with the ninth line, we find, "Nevertheless, with a person we dislike, we take the bit in our teeth. It is harder to go to an enemy than to a friend, but we find it much more beneficial to us. We go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill-feeling and expressing our regret. In the next paragraph, on page 77, the authors even provide us with instructions on what to say. Under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. Simply we tell him that we will never get over drinking until we have done our utmost to straighten out the past. We are there to sweep off our side of the street, realizing that nothing worthwhile can be accomplished until we do so, never trying to tell him what he should do. His faults are not discussed. We stick to our own. If our manner is calm, frank, and open, we will be gratified with the result."
The authors explain what to do about our debts. "We may not like the sacrifice required to make good on our bills, but sacrifice we must. The process forces us to rely on God for guidance, which takes us out of self-will and into God's will. Under God's direction, we find it much easier to make restitution than we ever thought possible." In the middle of page 78, they write, "Most alcoholics owe money. We do not dodge our creditors. Telling them what we are trying to do, we make no bones about our drinking. They usually know about it anyway, whether we think so or not. Nor are we afraid of disclosing our alcoholism on the theory it may cause financial harm. Approached in this way, the most ruthless creditors will sometimes surprise us. Arranging the best deal we can, we let these people know we are sorry. Our drinking has made us slow to pay. We must lose our fear of creditors no matter how far we have to go, for we are liable to drink if we are afraid to face them. Keep in mind that courage is not the absence of fear. Courage is facing the fear and walking through it." Then on the top of page 79, the Big Book authors again instruct us to ask God for guidance. Are you starting to see a pattern here? Starting to see about asking God to help us each step of the way? I don't think any of this is in here by accident. This reliance on God is essential if we are to outgrow the fears that have separated us from our Creator. Although these reparations take innumerable forms, there are some general principles which we find guiding. Reminding ourselves that we have decided to go to any lengths to find a spiritual experience, we ask that we be given strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences may be. We may lose our position or reputation or face jail, but we are willing. We have to be. We must not shrink at anything.
The Big Book authors suggest we ask others for help before we make some of our most or more difficult amends. We need direction, preferably from someone who understands the inventory and restitution process. We must make sure we do not create further harm as we clean up our side of the street. At the top of page 80, they write, "Before taking drastic action which might implicate other people, we secure their consent. If we have obtained permission, have consulted with others, ask God to help, and the drastic step is indicated, we must not shrink." In the first paragraph on page 82, we are yet again instructed to ask God for guidance as we make good on our past misdeeds. Perhaps there are some cases where the utmost frankness is demanded. No outsider can appraise such an intimate situation. It may be that both will decide that the way of good sense and loving kindness is to let bygones be bygones. Each might pray about it, having the other one's happiness uppermost in mind. This is an example of how we must be tactful and considerate of others as we make our amends. Nobody said it would be easy. It just has to be done. In the next several paragraphs on page 82, the Big Book authors state quite emphatically that stopping drinking is only the beginning. We must take additional action if we are to recover from alcoholism. Sometimes we hear an alcoholic say that the only thing he needs to do is to keep sober. Certainly he must keep sober, for there will be no home if he doesn't. But he is yet a long way from making good to the wife or parents whom for years he has so shockingly treated. The alcoholic is like a tornado, roaring his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken. Sweet relationships are dead. Affections have been uprooted. Selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. We feel a man is unthinking when he says that sobriety is enough. Not drinking is not enough. The big book authors make that very clear. At the top of page 83, they write, "Yes, there is a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. A remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fill the bill at all. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it, being very careful not to criticize them. Their defects may be glaring, but the chances are that our own actions are partly responsible. So we clean house with the family, asking each morning in meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love." Asking God again. Yep. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Here we're told that in order to recover from alcoholism, we have to live the AA program. So we don't just take the steps. We live the steps on a daily basis.
Then further down on page 83, the authors give us directions on what to do if we can't make amends to someone face to face. And I've had the opportunity to pass this on many occasions when discussing fourth and when doing fifth steps. There may be some wrongs we can never fully right. We don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we would right them if we could. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. The authors conclude the ninth step with another list of benefits. Starting at the bottom of page 83, they tell us precisely what is going to happen once we commence to clear away the wreckage of our past. They describe these benefits as promises. The Big Book is filled with promises, and these are just a few of them. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook toward life will change. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. We'll intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We'll suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. That's not maybe they'll materialize. They will always materialize if we work for them. And it is. What a message of hope. It's almost beyond comprehension that all these wonderful events will occur if we just make our amends to those whom we have harmed. But they will happen. That's a guarantee.
Dr. Bob, our Akron, Ohio co-founder, found that he could not stay sober until he made his amends. He accomplished this in one day. At the top of page 156, we read about Dr. Bob's ninth step. One morning he took the bull by the horns and set out to tell those he feared what his trouble had been. He found himself surprisingly well received and learned that many knew of his drinking. Imagine that. Imagine that, huh?
Yeah, imagine.
Stepping into his car, he made the rounds of people he had hurt. He trembled as he went about, for this might meet ruin, particularly to a person in his line of business. At midnight, he came home exhausted, but very happy. He has not had a drink since. This concludes our discussion of step 9. For the newcomers, part of your assignment for the next week is to start on your amends list. If you are not sure how to proceed with a specific amends, ask your sponsor or spiritual advisor for help. Next week, we will take steps 10, 11, and 12. Before we end this session, we will want to lay the groundwork for the 11th step. This is the step that puts us directly in contact with the God of our understanding.
And I know that some of us did get a head start on this, but I want to take us through as a group one more time. The 11th step reads, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Right from the beginning, the Big Book authors have been preparing us for this conscious contact by interspersing references about receiving guidance from God. So before looking ahead to the 11th step, we're going to look back at some of the previous Big Book references to guidance. Let's start by defining the word guidance. Since the Big Book was written in the late 1930s, we're using a dictionary from that period. We must be sure we know what the Big Book authors meant when they wrote the word, not what the word means today, in 1946. The verb to guide is defined as to lead or direct, influence or regulate. Two synonyms are to disclose and to show. Now let's look for the passages in the Big Book where the authors use the words that refer to guidance. There are over a dozen of them. And to date I've come up with 18. We just read one of them a few minutes ago. Let's go back to page 83 and look again at the last sentence in the first paragraph. It reads, asking each morning in meditation that our Creator show us, in other words, guide us, in the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. So each day we ask God to show us the right way to live. In other words, we ask God to guide us in our actions.
There are many references to guidance, starting all the way back to the first step. We're only going to mention a few of them. On page 13 in Bill's story, our New York City co-founder talks about meditation and guidance. Starting with the third line in the fourth paragraph, Bill writes, I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as He would have me. The term sit quietly is similar to the Oxford Group concept of quiet time, which is a daily morning meditation. It is common practice for Oxford Group members to write down the guidance they receive during this quiet time so they can check what they have written against a set of standards referred to as the Four Absolutes. Four Absolutes are honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love. Process is based on the belief that God speaks and that He will guide and direct anyone who is willing to listen. They write down what they hear so they can separate the self thoughts from the God thoughts and then take the appropriate actions. They believe that if they have written what they have written is honest, pure, unselfish, and loving, these thoughts are from God. If what they have written is dishonest, resentful, selfish, or fearful, these thoughts are from self. The Big Book authors also believe that God speaks, as we will learn next week. Our Creator communicates with us through inspiration, an intuitive thought, or a decision. On page 57, the authors tell us that God is going to speak to us. He has come to all who have honestly sought Him. When we draw near to Him, He disclosed Himself to us. When the Big Book authors write, He disclosed Himself to us, they are implying that God will reveal Himself to us. At the bottom of page 69, we find yet another reference to guidance. Starting with the sixth line in the third paragraph, the Big Book authors write, in meditation we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. How is God going to provide us with the right answer? He's going to tell us. That's why it's so important to learn how to listen.
These are just a few examples from the Big Book on prayer and meditation. They are sufficient to get started. We now know what we need to do in order to find the spirit of the universe. We're going to provide you with some additional material on how to establish a conscious contact with God. In the late 1930s, a member of the Oxford Group wrote a short essay titled, How to Listen to God. It is one of the clearest set of instructions we have found on how to meditate. We will briefly take you through this four-page pamphlet. We suggest you conduct your daily morning meditation based on these guidelines. Next week, let us know what happened. The Oxford Group author begins the pamphlet with a statement. These are a few simple suggestions for people who are willing to make an experiment. You can discover for yourself the most important and practical thing any human being can ever learn, how to be in touch with God. At the bottom of the first page, the authors give us prerequisites. Anyone can be in touch with God, anywhere at any time, if the conditions are obeyed. And these are the conditions. Actually, quite simple. To be still and quiet, to listen, to be honest about every thought that comes, to test the thoughts to be sure they come from God, and to obey. In the remaining pages of the pamphlet, the author provides additional insights into how it works. On the second page, he tells us, write. Here is the important key to the whole process. Write down everything that comes into your mind, everything. Writing is simply a means of recording so that you can remember later.
On the third page, he shows us how to sort out the God thoughts from our own thoughts. Take a good look at what you have written. Not every thought we have comes from God. So we need to test our thoughts. Here's where the written record helps us to be able to look at them. A, are they completely honest, pure, unselfish, loving? B, are they in line with our duties to our family, to our country? Are they in line with our understanding of the teachings found in our spiritual literature? The author of the pamphlet tells us to test our guidance using the Oxford Group Four Absolutes of Honesty, Purity, Unselfishness, and Love. In AA, we use the opposites of the Four Absolutes as a test for self-will. The test is described three times in our big book. Last week, we learned how to use this test in the fourth step to complete our moral inventories. In addition, the test is also used as a part of our 10th and 11th steps. Let's look again at how the big book authors use the test for self-will in the fourth step. The Alcoholics Anonymous test for self-will is selfishness or selfish, dishonesty, self-seeking, and frightened or fear. In the Oxford Group test for God's will, it's the opposite, is unselfishness, honesty, purity, and love. We can use the same test to check our guidance. If what we have written is selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened, we can be assured those words are based in self-will and therefore are not from God. So we can use either the AA test for self-will or the Oxford Group test for God's will to check your guidance. Doesn't really matter.
Now back to the Oxford Group pamphlet. The author next asks us to check our guidance. Here is where your sponsor or spiritual advisor can be very helpful. Check. When in doubt and when it is important, what does another person who is living two-way prayer think about this thought or action? More light comes in through two windows than one. Someone else who also wants God's plan for our lives may help us see more clearly. Talk over together what you have written. Many people do this. They tell each other what guidance has come. This is the secret of unity. There are always three sides to every question. Your side, my side, and the right side. Mm-hmm. Guidance shows us which is the right side, not which side is right. Then the author explains what to many of us is the most difficult part of all. Obey. Carry out the thoughts that have come. You will only be sure of guidance as you go through with it. A rudder will not guide a boat unless the boat is moving. As you obey, very often the results will convince you that you are on the right track. And remember, God has given us free will. We're free not to listen to God's guidance. But we must be prepared to accept the consequences if we're not willing to follow our Creator's plan for our lives.
The author tells us what we need to do if we don't hear any definite thoughts during our meditation. He says it is a sign that we haven't completely cleared up the wreckage of our past. We need to make additional amends. He writes, if I am not receiving thoughts when I listen, the fault is not God's. Usually it's because there is something I will not do, something wrong in my life that I will not face and make right, a habit or indulgence I will not give up, a person I will not forgive, a wrong relationship in my life I will not give up, a restitution I will not make, or something God has already told me to do that I will not obey. Look this list over. Most of these items are described in the big book as part of our inventory and restitution process. If we have been thorough and honest in steps 4 through 9, we will have removed the blocks that have prevented us from establishing a two-way communication with God. So you have two assignments for this week. Start making amends to those whom you have harmed and practice prayer and meditation each morning. Write down your guidance and bring it with you next week. As for results, they are described on the bottom of the page of How to Listen to God's pamphlet. This is the way of life for everyone, everywhere. Anyone can be in touch with the living God anywhere, anytime, if we fulfill His conditions. When man listens, God speaks. When man obeys, God acts. This is the law of prayer. We wish you the very best as you leave here to make your amends and to establish your conscious contact with the God of your understanding. Miracles are definitely about to occur, and we are looking forward to hearing about them next week. We will see you then. Are there any questions?